Welcome back to Copper Country Today. I'm your host, Rick Allen. Joining me in studio right now, I have a couple of folks from the Houghton Keweenaw Genealogical Society, the group president, Avis West, and vice president, Doug Terrell. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, I want to start off with just tell me a little bit about the society, about how long it's been and what you do.
Well, we've been around for 17 years. We generally work on our own research, but as a society, we work for helping to preserve local records. Like right now, we're working on a collection of lawyer records that the National Park acquired. We're rehousing them and indexing them and that kind of thing. So we usually try to do anything that'll help genealogists find out about their family. So we've done quite a bit of indexing and quite a bit of we did a project on the families that lost people in 1913 strike, and I think that we've only had two publications. That was our first one, and then the most recent one, the Osceola Mine Fire.
And we're going to be talking about that a little bit more in the moment here. How many people are involved with the society?
Well, we have roughly 150 members, but about half of those are not local. So we have about 75 local people. The people that actually attend is a lot lower than that because people are busy. But, usually when we're looking for volunteers, we have quite a few step forward.
Well, in addition to helping individuals and helping them guide them and educate them on their path of finding their genealogy, you hold a certain number of events, special events. One of them that you mentioned was the Osceola Mine Fire Tragedy Anniversary.
Right.
You did a lot of work with that and put together a presentation. I love history, and every time I turn over a stone here, I find more history in this area because it's so rich. This was not a story that I was familiar with, just hadn't heard it yet, but can you kind of give us the background of it?
Well, in 1895, September 7th, there was a fire in the Osceola Mine on the 27th level, and 30 men died. The unfortunate part about that tragedy was if they had done what they were told to do, which was get out of the mine, the death rate would have been much lower. It probably would have been like four or five the men that were actually fighting the fire. But they all died from smoke inhalation. They suffocated. And some of those men sat down and they had lunch before they came up, even after they had been warned. Some of them sat down, smoked a cigar, had a cigarette. There was not a lot of wood in that mine, so they didn't think that the fire was really going to be dangerous. And the fire itself wasn't. It was the smoke it created. And it basically permeated through the whole mine. And it happened in shaft number 3, but it went, it circled into shaft 4, and they're all connected, so it could move easily. The smoke could move easily from the different shafts. So the shaft number 3 was the shaft that they normally used to leave the mine. And it was an updraft shaft, or downdraft shaft. But when the fire started, it became an updraft shaft, so it was like a chimney. And so they couldn't use that form of exit. They had to find another way to get out of the mine. And most of that meant climbing ladders. Some of them were climbing from the 26th level, the 17th level, and if every level is about 80 feet, that's a lot of climbing. So,
was there ever any indication of what caused the fire?
They were never able to determine it. They know where the fire was. They didn't know whether somebody threw a candle into a pile of wood in what they called lagging. It was wood that they used to support the roof and things like that. But they could never make a final determination whether it was actually someone set it on purpose or whether it was an accident.
Now, with the information that you shared about the state of mind and of the miners and how they get out, was all that work already done, or did you have to start from scratch when putting this together?
We basically started from scratch. We knew about the fire. We knew that 30 miners had been lost. We were looking for a project that we felt hadn't really been covered, and we basically started. Basically went through the death certificates. Not all of them had death certificates. Some had Some were listed as dying and didn't die, which was kind of interesting. Then we started reading the newspapers, looking for anything that was written about the mine fire. And the newspapers, there were articles and papers as far away as Australia about this mine fire. But Wisconsin, California, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, all had articles about them, and some of the articles were just way off base. You know, some of them had 42 men dying, some of them, you know, I mean, it was, you know, just a lot of misinformation about who died. We had to straighten out. That was the biggest thing, is straightening out who actually died and what their name actually was, because the newspaper reports were very different from one newspaper to the other.
Well, even today, that's, you know, an issue, just, you know, with reporting news and being that you kind of report the news that you get. You know, we take a lot of sometimes heat for things that are wrong, but usually what's wrong because we were given an incorrect information.
Right.
You know, and so the newspapers then, you had multiple newspapers, you had multiple languages in newspapers.
Yep.
So I'm sure that created the sort of the
and multiple spellings on names. You know, the only ones that were easy were names like Williams and Mattson and, you know, some of the really common names, but a lot of them were Polish, Irish. No, there might not have been any Irish. Cornish, you know, and so it was, they were spelled a lot of different ways. So just determining which was the correct spelling was a big part of it.
Were you successful in finding people that were descendants from those that died in that fire?
Doug, the families he did, a lot of the people in the society took a family and then researched them. So we had, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 people that were, each took one or two families or three families. But the families that Doug did, he was very successful finding descendants.
Of the 5 families that I researched, I was able to contact a descendant of 4 of them. And the 5th one, they had no descendants.
Oh. Okay. The other 4 that you were able to contact, did they know about the fire? Was that part of their family history?
Yes, it was. And I was surprised. They knew about the tragedy and were able to fill in some blanks on who the children were. In some cases, I got photographs of the miners themselves.
Wow.
That died in the fire.
And that had to be rewarding for all that work.
Absolutely.
So when you held the couple of presentations, you had one that was in the Portage Lake District Library, mm-hmm. and there was a second one you mentioned.
In the Calumet Library.
Okay. The people, you know, what did you talk about during that presentation?
Basically, Doug talked about the families, and I talked about what had happened and what we found. And because it was kind of an interesting story. There were 30 men that died, but we had come across a news article that was written like 10-11 years after the fire, where there were a lot more victims that didn't die but had suffered from effects of the smoke. They listed people that went insane, you know, that people had their hair had turned white, you know, very shortly. They had a lot of lung problems because of the smoke inhalation. So there were a lot more victims. They just didn't die from the fire.
But at the Calumet presentation, we did have one descendant.
Yeah.
Did you?
That attended.
What was the impact of the families at the time when this happened?
You know, I think there was a lawyer from Milwaukee that was trying to get everybody to sign up for a lawsuit against the mine, and he was only successful in signing up one person. So that kind of tells you that the people didn't really blame the mine for what happened. They, you know, they had to cover over all the mine shafts, but they were very conscious about not trying to do it too soon, even though they knew that nobody could still be living down there. But they were thinking about what how the families would react if they, you know, within an hour covered over the mine shaft so more people couldn't get out. And I suspect that the mine offered the families some kind of settlement. I read a report from the mine that they talked about that they had signed up so many people that said that they would not sue, and I'm assuming that they gave them some kind of consideration for doing that. I think they didn't really blame the mine, You know, the mine had done everything that they could.
But they still had to carry on with losing the head of the household, though, in most cases.
Yes.
The fathers and sons.
Yep.
Those kinds of things, you know, really intrigue me so much. The, you know, not only the, just the history of it, but the way that it, you know, it is still so important in this area, and the, and how it, you know, you had a descendant at the one presentation, and people remember that history from well over 100 years ago now. And you deal with so many people retracing their family lines and finding out that they were part of things maybe they didn't realize, or that they had, you know, family members who were, you know, part of the 1913 strike, or had just been a part of our rich history here. When people come to you to start learning about their genealogy, how do you direct them to begin that process?
Well, the first thing that we always recommend is talk to the people that are around you, your parents, grandparents, cousins, and see what they know, because that's your starting point. You'll get the stories, you'll get the where they were born, or at least where they think they were born, and that allows you to start checking from that point. So that's the first thing we do, is talk to those nearest to you.
How do you do that? At the meetings, people come, or do they contact you?
Well, we don't actually do that research at the meetings. Most of our meetings, we provide instruction on how to use the resources that are available to you, census records, archive records, online records. So as far as actually talking to somebody, let's say a grandparent, we just suggest that they sit down and have a discussion.
We also have people contact us through our website or our email address, and we have a beginner's booklet that if they're just starting, that we give them. That gives them some pointers of where to go and what they should be looking for and that kind of thing.
From my own personal experience, it was starting that was really kind of the hardest part. As I've mentioned in this program before, I myself was raised in the Detroit area. I was born actually in Connecticut because my father was a Navy man. And as far as our family history was known verbally, it went back to my grandfather, who was, you know, in Detroit and passed away, was buried downstate. And then there was a grandfather who lived up here, but I didn't even know about him or anybody else in the family. And I ended up getting a job up here, obviously, and that was when I was told, oh, yeah, we had family up there, but we don't know if there is anybody. We don't suspect there are. So when I was up here, somebody had sent me to the Michigan Tech Archives. And so I went there and was able to find original family members who came over from Cornwall. We didn't even know we were Cornish. And that was in 1877. So his mother and then Christopher and his wife Elizabeth all came. They're both on the same card as arriving in 1877. It didn't list any other family members other than those three. And from that, I was able to start following a few different pieces. A lot of it was in the books, in the archives. Found a family burial plot with all the people I just mentioned buried there, plus a number of people I'd never heard of before. Found out that my great-great-grandfather had received the Silver Star Award in World War I. Again, nobody in my family even knew he existed, much less what that award was for. Came to find about a year later that my great-grandfather graduated from Lake Linden High School, and his picture is still up in the hallway there. And I found that out by visiting the school, and was just looking through it. And my wife said, "This is your great-grandfather." And we walked over, and sure enough, it was Robert Williams. So it was really surprising, you know, from my end. After you found one or two pieces of the puzzle, you were sort of like finding those end pieces when you're putting together a jigsaw puzzle. Once you have that, you know, a little bit, you have a starting point and was able to follow that to bigger pieces.
Right. I think that people who are just starting out with genealogy will be surprised to learn how much is actually out there, how much information is available. Normally you think that there's not going to be much to research for a great-grandfather, But when you start digging in the records and finding out what's there, you're almost overwhelmed with how much there is.
And I made a mistake. It was actually it would have been my grandfather who graduated from Lakeland and Hubble's. My great grandfather is buried in, I think it's the school, is it Schoolcraft Cemetery?
Correct.
With his wife, he married into the Bissonnette family. He's buried with his wife there. And my grandfather is buried downstate. So I just had that mixed up a little bit, which I'm sure happens when we're talking about family histories.
Another key is most people had a reason to move someplace, such as up here, and usually there's some family or neighborhood connection to other people that were already here. So when you find out that somebody moved here, start checking on cousins and the other relatives or somebody that was in a nearby village, and you may find that connection as to why they moved to this area.
Now, does the advent of the internet make genealogy just so much?
It has made it almost too easy. But the caveat that we always tell people is be careful with what you find, because in many cases there are mistakes or some half-truths in there. So we always tell people that's a good starting point, but you need to verify everything you find with another source.
What about the popular sites? There's some well-advertised sites for genealogy. Do those tend to be better, or do you have to be more cautious of them?
Well, some of the information is factual. World War II records, World War I records, census records, those are the actual records. Now, they in and of themselves sometimes contain errors. The place where you have to use some discretion is when somebody has posted their family tree online at those sites, saying this was my father or grandfather and the rest of the line. In many cases those have errors, so don't assume they're correct.
Okay, they're clues, not facts per se.
Absolutely.
It's a guideline.
There's a start point.
Yeah.
Now with military records, I ran into a problem where you had to be immediate family. It was hard to be immediate family from somebody that's 2-3 generations behind you. And so have you seen, you know, how do you overcome that hurdle?
Well, there's two main sources of records, military records. One is the IDPF, which is the individual deceased members file. And that's for those that were killed in a conflict. In most cases, that requires you to be an immediate family member, especially if it's in the recent past. But they've been pretty liberal with allowing folks to access those records. So if you're a cousin and explain why you need it, they usually will let you see it. The other records, which are the personnel files, after 62 years, those become archival and are open to the public.
How do you get a hold of them?
You have to write the facility that holds those. I don't know those off the top of my head. We did give a presentation on that, and we have that information. But be prepared to wait for months. Unfortunately, in 1973, there was a fire at the storage facility in St. Louis, and many of the World War II records were destroyed. The military will try and recreate those records for you. But for probably 2/3 of the Army and Army Air Corps records, they don't have the originals anymore.
See, these are questions I'm sure you get when you do gather and people are looking for information. I also would imagine it's helpful when you have the meetings for people to share, I guess, with each other about things that they've learned or roadblocks that they've hit and how other people have overcome it. I'm just picturing, you saw how excited I get just talking about my brief venture into my family's past. I'm sure talking with somebody else who's going through that same thing, and then it's like, have you tried this, or did you discover that?
Right, and that's one of the, I would say one of the main benefits of the membership is that you can talk to other people that have encountered a similar problem in the past and find out how they solved it.
Now, as president and vice president of the society, have you done a pretty intricate background into your own families? Is that something that you have done?
Well, I have some of mine back into the 1640s when they came into the U.S.
Wow.
And then I have some that I'm still hammering on, trying to figure out where they came from. But I've been at it about 25, 30 years, so I've gotten quite a bit done. But it's a never-ending process.
Well, and prior to 1640, where did those family members come from?
England.
Yeah. Have you ever gone back to try looking in England to find out, you know, who knows, you might be royalty?
I don't think I was royalty. I don't think my family was royalty. But, I'd love to make a trip to England and visit some of the areas where they came from, because both my side of my family and my husband's side of the family all came from England. So it would be an interesting trip to make.
Do you enjoy working with other people as they're going through that discovery?
Well, I enjoy helping them. And you know, we won't do the research, but we'll give them pointers and give them guidelines and, you know, try this or try that or what have you tried, so we can say, well, you know, you might try this. And, you know, because we've had a lot of experience with a lot of different kinds of records that a lot of them aren't online. That's amazing. It's not all online yet, but it's getting there, but it's not yet.
Well, what's the biggest obstacle people usually hit that's so hard to get past?
They go online and they go to Ancestry and they don't find their family, and so they think they've hit a roadblock. And it may be a spelling error, you know, it may be that the information's there, they're just searching wrong. And it may be that it's not on the internet. Yeah, you have to kind of do it the old way, write letters and you know, go to archives and things like that.
Well, especially if you're looking for records like from around here, a lot of them are in a box somewhere in a basement of one of these villages. I mean, I've seen them.
Yeah.
You know,
and a lot of them are gone, like cemetery records for the abandoned cemeteries. You know, the only lists that really exist are the ones that people have created from reading the stones or looking at death records and that kind of thing. So
the time it takes to research your family history, is that another big obstacle?
You know, it, the more time you have to devote, the farther you're going to get. But it's the kind of thing that, you know, if you just have an hour a week, then, you know, it just takes you longer, you know. So I guess usually when you retire, you have a lot more time to do it.
Has there been more of an interest in these last few years than there has been in the past to do this?
Yeah, I think because of the internet has, yeah.
Right. I think because of the internet, people are more aware of what's out there, and they hear about genealogy, and so they wonder, who are my ancestors, and where did they come from?
But say 20, 30 years ago, before the internet was here, just the family stories.
Well, you did a lot of writing.
Yeah.
A lot of writing, going to courts. And, you know, doing the research that way as opposed to just hopping on the internet.
It's made it easier to start.
Yeah,
you can, the internet, you know, type in your name in Google and you'd be surprised what you find.
You had mentioned membership. Do you join the society and pay your membership fee?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. Can you talk a little bit about that? What if you wanted to go full boat and join, what would you do?
Well, it costs, starting next year, it's going to be $15 a year. And we have a website where we post databases that are just specifically for members, and we post databases that are for just anybody that wants to look at them. We have meetings, you know. A lot of people contact us, and, you know, we try to help them whether they're members or not. You don't have to be a member to come to the meetings. They're open to the public.
How do they contact you?
We have a website, which is hkcgs.org. That's the initials of the society. And you can contact us through that. And then the public library has some of our collection there. And I think we have like our beginner book there that you can pick up. And I think there's contact information in there.
Sort of a final word of advice for somebody that's been intrigued, or they've, you know, learned something they didn't know about. Why should they continue doing this? What would be their reward?
I think there's two big reasons. One, for me, I'm a history buff. It personalizes history. Suddenly you find that you have that relative that was part of that event or part of that migration and makes you aware of it. I think the other part is the connectedness you feel with a larger group. You suddenly realize there are a lot of people out there that are related to you.
Well said. Doug and Avis, thank you for coming on the program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Copper Country Today, we'll be right back.